Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy. Welcome back, Simon here. This conversation is with Nigel Owens, the much-loved former rugby referee and TV personality. The theme of our conversation is self-acceptance and forgiveness. And this was recorded live at the Hay Festival. I hope you enjoy listening.
What a lovely applause. Thank you all very much for coming out here. It is a little overcast today, a little bit rainy, but and I may be clutching at straws, but it does seem to be brightening up just a tad. Today, the theme of our chat is self-acceptance, which is obviously something very important in life for all of us, relevant to every single person. Everyone has bits of themselves that they prefer to other bits, shall we say. And I'm delighted to say I have got to discuss this theme, a national treasure. That's a fact. That's a fact, isn't it? Nigel Owens, here we are, you know, we're in Hay, we're in Wales, and Nigel...
Just,
that's close enough. You are a national treasure. Do you accept that?
I'm not sure I do, actually. No,
humble.
It's nice when people say that. Of course it is. Yeah, I don't really think of it like that, to be honest. I just like to think of myself as just being me. And I think that's hugely important in life, I think. You know, don't try to be somebody else or somebody you're not. Whatever you do in life, whatever walk of life, sport, or whatever you do in life, I think it's hugely important that you be yourself and you're allowed to be yourself as well, I think. And you know, thankfully that's what I've allowed to be, and that's who I am, just being me. And when people do say nice things, of course it's lovely to hear that, but you know that around the corner there's something else can be said as well after refereeing a match, so that can change overnight, believe me.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I was brought up in very much a rugby house. You're obviously a rugby man, and do you remember the player John Douglas? Scottish player. Anyway, basically,
no,
so just to put it in context, he had a bit of a widow's peak, touch of almost the receding hairline. My father decided to shave his hair in the same way as an homage to John Douglas, but it never grew back. So my father instilled in me an appreciation of rugby's legends. His favourite, along with John Douglas, was Willie John McBride. Me, as a number 10, it was between Johnny Wilkinson and, of course, Jonathan Davies. But as well, the nice thing I think about rugby as well, some of the legends aren't just players. Now, I think of Bill McLaren, and for my 21st birthday, my father bought me his final match notes from his long career, and he's a legend for his broadcasting. And I think most people here would agree, you're a legend for the way you referee in rugby, because you do have a unique style.
Yeah, that's one way of calling it. Yeah, I suppose, but then it just goes back to who I am. You know, I was brought up in West Wales in a small village called Mynydd Cerrig, which pretty much is, you translate it to English and it translates to mountain of stone. That's pretty much what it was, small village, right on the border between the two valleys, the Gwendraith Fach and the Gwendraith Fawr. And the Gwendraith Fach Valley is where you sort of head down the limestone quarries and then into the agricultural land of Carmarthenshire further on. And then just to this side of the Gwendraith Fawr Valley, you know, you head on down then to the mining communities of the Gwendraith Valley and on to sort of Llanelli and the old steelworks and all the mining communities. So I'm right between both the agricultural side and the mining industrial side of the Gwendraith Valley, and a lot of that upbringing is you're brought up in that small community in an old-fashioned way, really, where the stories, the humour is a huge part of everyday life. And I was brought up in this small village in Mynydd Cerrig, a population of about 140 people in the whole village. Spend a lot of time, your family's very close to you. So when my dad was working in the mines and in the quarry, my mum was to work a couple of hours in the school canteen, and then when you get home from work, your grandparents are looking after you, or your uncle or auntie. So there's older people's influence on you as a young person. And I was brought up in this village in the 1970s. And if you want to imagine what being brought up in Mynydd Cerrig was like in the 1970s, then go there now, because because nothing's changed. So it was my upbringing, I think. And I think a lot of people will tell you that life is what you make it. And I believe before you get to that stage in your life, I believe life will have made you. The influences and people around you, where you're brought up, the way you're brought up by your mum and dad or your guardians, and taught what is right and wrong, taught what the values and what your moral compasses are, that value of respect, to say those little words of please and thank you, and to respect people who are older than you, and the friends you spend your time with, the community you're brought up in, the school you go to, the friends you spend your time, the sporting clubs you participate in, and the influence on your uncle, your auntie, or your cousins, and all this on you when you're growing up as a young person has a huge influence here now, I believe, as a person you will become probably for the rest of your life. There's always exceptions to the norms, of course there is, but I'm a huge believer that there's a huge influence on you as a young person growing up, and that contributes a huge amount to you as a type of person you will be when you're older. And I was brought up in that sort of close-knit, old-fashioned Welsh family way. Humour was a huge part of it, and it's become who I am, I guess. And I couldn't speak English until I was 8 years of age, until I was taught it in school and then started communicating at about 8 years of age, when a few non-Welsh speaking people moved into the village and a couple of kids were my age, and that's when I started speaking English for the first time. So you may hear the odd word of Welsh coming out and you'll be thinking, what the hell did you just say? And it's because I'm trying to think of what the English word is. So yeah, I think the upbringing really sort of adds to you as a person, and that sort of that humour has always been. And when I'm on that rugby field, I'm just me, I'm just myself, you know. And I think it's important you don't go out in that field to try to be humorous and to say things because you think people's going to think they're funny. Because when you penalise somebody, which may mean they're going to lose the game, or you send somebody off, then you can't laugh and make a joke and smile about that. There's a time and place for the humour. And I've just sort of, I suppose, had that natural ability, I guess, in knowing the time of using that humour and that smile. Because, you know, as they say, comedy is all about the timing.
Hey! Well done. And you do use humour to de-escalate situations. And if anyone goes on YouTube, there are numerous sort of highlight clips of Nigel's best bits. And I sort of like watching them. And there's, for example, was it Chris Robshaw? He was sort of giving you a bit of back chat and you just went, Christopher. And he just zipped his mouth right there and then. And on off he trotted. My favourite one is one that you come up with a lot, which is where you say, this is not soccer. And that has a desired effect. And then there was another match as well when both sides were getting a bit uppity. And you called the whole team, including all the wingers, to surround you. And is this the one where you said, behave like adults and I'll treat you as adults, and sent them on their way? And it just immediately de-escalated the situation. So humour is very powerful at doing that, particularly in rugby.
Yeah, I couldn't mean. I think humour is hugely powerful in every walks of life and in every day of life, particularly in the sort of society and culture we live today, where there's a huge blame culture, where political correctness, I believe, has gone to the extreme. There's no common sense anymore, and people are sort of afraid of saying something in case somebody gets offended. Now, nobody should say anything to intentionally offend people, but I think sometimes you need to have a bit of common sense in understanding the context of something is said. And, you know, we could all take something out of context and find something to be offended by. And I think that's a great shame of the society we live in today. And I believe humour has helped me hugely. You know, it diffuses those situations where people are thinking, what the hell am I going to say here now? And all of a sudden, I remember reffing a game in Harlequins, and I think it was Montpellier in the European Cup. And Dave Ward was playing hooker for Harlequins, and he chucked the ball into the line-out. And I've seen nothing like it before. And I've been refereeing 32 years since I was 16 years of age, and I've never seen anything like this. He threw the ball in, and the ball literally went to the scrum half's hands over there. And everybody in the game just stopped and looked. What the hell happened there? And Dave Ward went bright red, and he was sorely embarrassed by what had happened. And everybody was waiting for somebody to say something. People didn't want to laugh in case he'd be offended. He sort of wanted somebody to make a laugh because it was such a bad throw in. And I just went, Well, I'm straighter than that throw. And and it just diffused. Everybody laughed. Dave Ward laughed, and everybody just got on with the game, you know. And so humour, I think humour is, once we lose the ability to laugh at ourselves and to have a joke and a laugh, because life can be so serious sometimes, once we lose that ability to laugh and, you know, not to sort of be offended at everything that's said, you know, there are things which are unacceptable to say, of course there are, but sometimes things need to be taken in the context of how it's said, why it's said, who says it, the way it's said is hugely important as well. And once we lose a sense of humour, then society will be very poor for it. So I'm a big believer in that humour is hugely important in everyday life and can diffuse sometimes the most tense of situations.
And you talk about values and humour being a value. And I think something about rugby that is so precious is, or are, the values that are endemic to the game. And to what respect, probably top of that tree within rugby, to what degree does that help you then when you do come out with your quips, your Christophers, your whatever else is, the fact that, you know, everyone knows that you don't chat back to the referee, unlike does happen in certain other aforementioned sports?
Well, I think that is one of the most fundamental values and ethos of rugby union as a sport, is that value of respect. Because what you have is at times a very brutal, violent game sometimes, particularly in the past gone days, where now it's much safer, much cleaner now. But, you know, you go back 20, 30 years ago, and even in that long, you know, players would boot somebody in the head on the floor and punch somebody from behind. There was violence going on in the game. And when you have that, you have to have a value of respect as well. That doesn't carry on then during the game, after it's been addressed, or after the game. So that is one of the most important core values of rugby union as a sport. And I think that is one of the things that sadly lacks in society today, is that value of respect. You know, because it shouldn't matter who you are, where you come from, what the colour of your skin is, who you're in love with, what your religious beliefs are. None of that should matter. As long as you were a decent human being, that you were to be treated the same as everybody else. No better and no worse, just the same. And I think that needs people to respect people who are different, people who have different values, different opinions, political opinions. If you look at the lack of respect that's going on at the moment in the Brexit debate that's going on, you know, people have a total lack of respect for people's different views on it. And once you lose that respect, then you lose that argument then. And I think respect is hugely important to society in everyday life, which sadly is lacking today. And rugby union still upholds the tradition of value of respect, I think, and has to continue to do so. And I think it's important that everybody's involved in the game still does that and holds a value of respect, and we show that rugby maintains that value of respect. Look, I don't think rugby can take the moral high ground above any other sport, because there are things rugby can do better and need to do better. We still see acts of thuggery on the field, but what I think rugby does do is deals with them. You know, the game is much cleaner, much safer now than it was, and when those issues do arise, and they do arise, those boundaries are being pushed, but rugby do deal with it better, I think, than a lot of other sports, and I think that is the difference, I think. And that's sadly what I would like to see football address more, as a value of respect, because football is such a massive global sport that it has more influence on society and young people in society in everyday life than any other sport in the world. And with that comes, I think, that a responsibility for everybody involved in the sport of football to conduct themselves in a way that influences young people in the proper way and not in the bad way. And when you see kids looking at Match of the Day and the way that players swear at each other, swear at match officials and everything that goes on in the sport in a bad way, then that filters down to the grassroots and to society in everyday life. And that's one thing I think rugby can learn a lot from football, but I think that's one thing that football and a lot of other sports and society can learn from rugby, is that value of respect, I think, to respect people who may be very different to you, but doesn't make you any better or any worse person than them, that they are different to you. And I think that is one thing that, as I said, today society lacks, and rugby needs to uphold the tradition of respect, because those boundaries are being pushed, and it's a challenge.
And that respect in rugby, do you think that that feeds into the lack of tribalism in rugby? Because, for example, so I was actually pitch side for the last international that Nigel was involved in, which was Scotland against France out in Paris. And the nice thing about rugby is all the fans sit together. And it's not a tribal sport, is it? How closely linked is that lack of... it looks like you might disagree, but how closely linked is that lack of tribalism? And
it is quite tribal. People are very, very passionate, you know. When you...
Respectfully so, though.
Yes.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Not maybe, but that's a minority. But what football has is a bigger minority, so the noise is bigger, the voice is bigger, because there's more of them, because the sport is globally bigger. People say it's a class thing. People say, well, you know, rugby is a middle-upper-class game. Well, yes, in some parts of the country, in other countries, it is, and as always has been, but that's changing, and it's now a game for all, and quite rightly so. But I don't really buy into that, because rugby in Wales has always been a working-class game. You know, the rugby clubs in Wales were built up around the communities of the mining communities, the working-class communities. I was brought up on a council estate, and I'm proud of that. Like many other people in Wales who brought up, who are involved in rugby, but they still have that value of respect instilled in them as a young person, and rugby instills that in you as a young person. So I don't think it is a class or a tribal thing. I think what football has allowed, I think, unfortunately, for a group of people to go to football matches and to express that violence, express that tribalism, and use that sporting as arena, as a platform, as an excuse to use that violence, and that's what I think. It has been addressed, in all fairness. You know, football stadiums are much safer now than they were back in the 70s and 80s, and we see a lot less of that violence now, and quite rightly so. So, you know, I think tribalism in football is much more than it is in rugby, which has a little bit more of a nastiness edge to it. But that's a minority of people. You know, the majority of people in football are good people and could sit next to it with their opposition supporters and enjoy the game. But unfortunately, there's a minority who can't, and that minority in football is bigger than what it is in other sports because of the size of the sport.
We're going to talk about more values, but I just want to take a very slight detour back in time again, because you did speak about that throw being completely off-centre, and it was a kick of equal lack of accuracy that actually led to you becoming a referee in the first place, wasn't it?
Yes. I was refereeing a game... I was playing a game in school... my sort of a school. I passed the LEM Plus. How the hell I passed it, I don't know, but I passed it. And I went to the Gwendraith Grammar School, and I was the last year to do the LEM Plus. And the last year to do the old O-levels, because then after 1 year in the grammar school, the education system changed in Wales, the grammar schools were phased out, and I went to my sort of a school, the Welsh Language School. And because we were a new school, there weren't many pupils in the school. It was a very small school, so we were a bare 15 in the rugby side. So by the time we were sort of 16 years of age, playing for the first 15, we were a bare 15, 16, 17 players. So I was getting my place, and that's the only way I was getting my place, because otherwise I wouldn't have been picked. And we're playing this game down in St. Clair's, and we hadn't won a game all year. And it was the last game of the season, and we've been hammered every game. And one of my best mates, Wayne Thomas, scored the try right underneath the post. And then my other best mate, Craig Bunnell, was captain. And Form 1, well, we used to call them Form 1, Form 2, and they now call them Year 7, Year 8. So we were in Form 5. And then Form 2 and Form 3, which is Year 8 and Year 9, were also playing a game. They'd finished their game because they were 5 minutes shorter. So they were all watching our game. So last try of the game, game was over, conversion had come right in front of the post to win the game. And I thought, well, I'll kick this now. I was playing fullback. And I lined up to kick it now, thinking I'd be a hero in school now. Last game of the season, first ever win. And I went to kick the ball, and it went closer to the corner flag than it did between the uprights. And my mates didn't speak to me for a couple of days. And John Bynan, the sports teacher, the late John Bynan, unfortunately, and John Bynan said to me, he said, Nigel, he said, for God's sake, will you go and referee or something? And I said, all right then. And then the following week, it was like a seven-a-side competition game in school. So I went to referee that game and enjoyed it. And that's how the refereeing started, just pure chance, just by missing that conversion. And I, you know, as I said, I played full back in school, but not a very good. Ray Gravel, the legend Ray Gravel, said something very similar to what John Bynan said to me when I was in school. And John Bynan said I was playing full back in the game. And John Bynan said after one game, the way I played in the game, he compared me to the great Welsh fullback of the 1970s, the legendary JPR Williams, when he said to me, Nigel, compared to JPR Williams, you were bloody useless. And I thought, fair point. And Ray Gravel always did the same thing. When I used to see Ray Gravel used to shout out from across the room wherever he saw me. He says, ah, Nigel Owens, the referee. Not a bad one. Not a very good one either. And that's what John Bynan compared me to my playing. So look, I would have never gone on to play at any. I'd have probably played for Ponabearim Youth and my local seconds 15 for a couple of years, you know, and that bit. But I started refereeing at 16 and have no regrets whatsoever.
Well, look, rugby should be very grateful that your place kicking is so dire. I think that's a fair point. So we've touched on humour as a value, and you are a man who recognises the importance of values in life. Indeed, on your email signatures, because we exchanged a few in the run-up to this chat, and as well, I think whether it's yours or the WRU's, the values are there spelt out at the bottom of your email signature. Is it fair to say the most important value to you, the top of the tree, is family?
Yes, it is, I think. Because no matter what you you go through in life, as far as a difficulty goes, or what you achieve in life as success, whether it's those really difficult times, or whether it's those hugely successful times, whatever one it is, unless you've got people that matter to you and care about you, around you, to share those successful times and to help you through those difficult times, then none of those times mean anything. And I think no matter what you have in life, that the most important thing in life is your family and your friends, I believe, because, as I said, you will... Sometimes in life, you will need some help. We all will, from some, whatever it's help in work to do something, as a kid in school, a bit of help with your schoolwork, with your exams, somebody doing some work at home, in your career, in your job. Everybody needs a bit of help, whether it's when you have those dark times. Whatever it is, you need a bit of help. And when you have your family and friends around you to help you, then you get through it. And then when you achieve something which you can look back with great joy and pride, unless you have someone to share them with, those happy, those good times, then it doesn't mean the same. So for me, the family is the most important thing for me. And I was brought up, my mum was one of six, my dad was one of seven. I'm the only child. I wish I had brothers and sisters, but I don't. But I got a lot of cousins who are the same age as me, and they got kids now. I got three or four godchildren. Some of my cousins, they're growing now, obviously, but they're very, very close family. And I had a barbecue on Sunday. There was about 45 of us there, you know, mostly family and friends as well. And And I think family is hugely, hugely important, I believe. And I was brought up in that, you know, close-knit family community. And, you know, I lost my mum 10 years ago now, so it's just me and my dad left as far as immediate family goes. And sometimes I do worry, you know, that my dad is 83 years of age, and I hope my dad will be here for another 20 years again, but there'll come a time, maybe I'll be gone before him, you don't know. But I do worry sometimes that, you know, that I don't become old and lonely sometimes, because to me, family around you is the most important thing. And I'm lucky, although I haven't got immediate family, I have a lot of close family around me, and I think that's hugely, hugely important, I think.
Yeah, and we'll come back to a couple of things you mentioned there. But speaking about your family and your friends and how they got you through what was your darkest moment, because you've spoken very eloquently, and indeed your book is on sale here that was released about a decade ago, just over, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, I think the Welsh one came out in 2008, and sort of rushed the... we didn't rush it really, but needed to get it out before, because my mum was diagnosed with terminal ill cancer, and they pretty much told her that she'd have a year to live, and pretty much a year it was. So I was halfway through doing the Welsh book then, so I wanted to get the Welsh book done before she passed away, and managed to do that, and that was in sort of came out in November 2008, I think, and then my mum passed away early January 2009, and then the English version of the book came out then a year later with an extra chapter in it, because obviously my mum had passed away in that meantime. So yeah, the book has been out now 10 years, but for some reason it's still selling, and which is a good thing, obviously, because it shows, you know, people are still interested in it and people are still enjoying it. So the Welsh book is out of print, but the English version is still selling, and selling pretty well as well.
And you've talked about the power of your book and indeed your message on other people, and it all comes down to the difficulty that you had in accepting yourself fully at one time and accepting your sexuality. And you've spoken about, you know, how to what extent you went into a really dark place. So however comfortable you are talking about that, can you share with us what you went through and, you know, the part your family played in helping you out of that?
It was a bit catch-22, to be honest with you, because living in a small community contributed a lot to the difficult times in one sense, because everybody knows everybody, and, you know, when some personal stuff going on in your life, then everybody seems to know about it in the village. But if you're living in a big city and, you know, you don't know who's living above you or next door to you or below you, and nobody really cares. And sometimes that is a godsend when you don't want people to know stuff. It contributed a lot to the difficult times, my close-knit of my family and the community I was living in. But then it also contributed in getting me through that as well. I was sort of brought up in that small village in an old-fashioned way. Went to Sunday school, went to chapel, and taught by your mum and dad that when you get older, you'll get a girlfriend, you get married, you'll get kids, and you become a grandparent, and that's the way the world keeps on going round. And I wouldn't want my upbringing to be any different, to be honest with you. And then at about 19 years of age, I started realizing that I was finding myself attracted to men. And this was something totally alien, something that I'd never experienced before. I had a girlfriend at the time, and something I knew nothing about. And I'd never, at 19 years of age, I'd never met or knew a gay person. The only sort of gay person that I knew of were some of the very camp characters that are on some of the sitcoms on TV back in the 70s, 80s, 90s. And I'm sitting there and watching, you know, the old programs like Are You Being Served and stuff like this, and Ain't I Fought Mum and some of these very, very camp characters, and hearing a lot of this derogatory language around me within my family about these characters and about gay people. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, I don't want to be gay. I'm not like that, so I can't be gay. I'm just hearing this language around me. You know, what, people are not going to accept me. People won't like it. And I was feeling scared, feeling lonely, and that contributed a lot then to some very difficult times. And in those difficult times, I sort of started getting mental health issues and getting very down, spending a lot of time on my own, drinking more, being lonely, not going out, not wanting people in case somebody would find something out or guess something, and started comfort eating by eating food continuously, and I put a lot of weight on. And I was still refereeing at the time, and then I wanted to lose this weight because I'd become overweight. And unfortunately, I became bulimic, which I still suffer from today, unfortunately, and not to the extent I did back then, where I would sort of eat my food and I'd make myself sick in the toilet, eat again, and it would be a constant cycle, 5, 6, 7 times a day sometimes, just eating my food, getting it all up. And then I went from 16 and a half, 17 stone down to something like 11 stone, so it was very thin, very pale. And I went to the gym, wanted to put some weight on and to make myself feel and look better, to get that body image that I would be happy with and other people may be happy with. And I started using steroids, and by the time I was 25, 26 years of age, I was in a very, very dark place, suffering from deep depression, mental health issues, anxiety, scared of going out. And and I did something one night that I will regret for the rest of my life, something that I have to live with for the rest of my life, where I left a note from my mum and dad and said, look, you know, didn't tell them why. I said, I just can't carry on in my life anymore. And I left the house, walked around where I was brought up, and slipped into a coma from what I had taken, and got airlifted to hospital. And I'd never forgive myself for what I put my mum and dad through when they got up that morning and read a note and thought that they were never going to see their only child ever again. And anyway, I got airlifted to hospital. I was unconscious. I was in intensive care for a couple of days and came out of that, and then in hospital for another 6 or 7 days, and people came to visit. My mum and dad came and still didn't tell anybody why. And the doctor said to me after I came out of intensive care, he said, look, you're a very, very lucky young man. You've been another 20, 30 minutes and it had been too late to save you. And everybody left one night after visiting hours, and then my mum came back after everybody gone. And my mum said to me, she said, look, I don't know why you did it. And if you don't want to tell me, then you're not going to tell me. But if you ever do anything like that again, then you may as well take me and your dad with you, because we don't want to live our life without you. And and she left, and I just started crying in the hospital bed on my own. And that was the moment that my life was saved. I realized to myself, well, I need to accept who I am. This is who I have. No choice. I can't put the people that I care about the most through what they've been through ever again. And I don't want to go through that myself ever again. And that was the biggest challenge in my life, was accepting my sexuality and who I was, because I fought so many years against it, not wanting to be that person. And refereeing that World Cup final between Australia and New Zealand in front of 85,000 people and millions of people watching all over the world, you know, the biggest game in world rugby that happens once every 4 years, brings with it a huge amount of pressure and is one of the biggest challenges in rugby, is to officiate that game. And but it was nothing compared to the challenge of accepting who I was. And and that night I accepted whom I was, and I realized, look, I have no choice. This is who I am, and I need to accept this. There are many things in life you can choose. You can choose whether you're a good person or a bad person, whether you play football, rugby, what sport you choose, where you go on holidays, what you eat, whether you drink. There are many, many things in life you can choose, but your sexuality is not one of them. And and that's what I realized by getting that second chance. And and then, you know, I accepted who I was, and then sort of slowly over the years got on with my life, really. And that is, I think, is the biggest challenge anybody will come across in your life. It may not be about your sexuality. It may be about issues you have at home, relationship issues, financial worries, kids worrying about schoolwork, exams, you know, whatever's worrying you and getting you down. Unless you accept there are issues in your life that you need to deal with, then you can't go on to the next stage of, right, what am I going to do about them? And the only way you'll get through them is by accepting there are issues that need dealing with. And the biggest advice I could give anybody is to talk about them. To talk about them with anybody. It doesn't matter who, family, close friends, a stranger, professional help, it doesn't matter. But until you accept and start talking about what is getting you down, then there's not much hope of you dealing with it and getting through it and getting better with it. And that's what I did. You know, I accepted who I was. It took me quite a few years after that to start telling people and then to move on with my life and be able to be myself. But as I said to you earlier, because rugby is the wonderful sport that it is, it allowed me to be myself. And look, you know, I was very, very fortunate to get a second chance. Unfortunately, some people don't, and it's it really sort of makes me sad when I hear of so many people in all walks of life that, you know, get to that dark place and don't see any way out. And there is a way out, and that is to talk about it and to deal with it in that way. I was lucky to get that second chance.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Just to pick up on as well something you said there about everyone has this to face in their life. Everyone, to some degree, as something that they have to accept about themselves that perhaps they're not hugely fond of. We're all human beings, and that's the way it is. No one is perfect. And I spoke to Mike Brearley on this podcast, former England captain turned psychoanalyst. And he said that, you know, if you don't accept something, it will find a way to play out. And often that will be in projection. So he gave the example of if someone is selfish but can't accept that about themselves, they will be very quick to see it in others. And then so people often project some of these things out. So, for example, as well, if someone is insecure, they may overcompensate for that. So to what degree do you think self-acceptance then is part of interlinked with authenticity?
I think self-acceptance, and it's very difficult to get us to the stage where you can accept other self-acceptance. I saw that. When I was in those difficult times in my late teens, early 20s, where I would be very derogatory if I heard about gay people or names of people who may be gay, and I was very derogatory towards them in sort of, well, you know, let's see how people, maybe it was my way of dealing with how are people going to react to me if they find out, how do they react to them? And you do see a lot of stuff, you know, in other people that you may be dealing with yourself. And I think the self-acceptance is hugely important for you to be able to get on with your life. You need to have the self-acceptance, but it's very difficult to get to the stage of self-accepting or to seek help so that you can self-accept, really. And it is a very, very difficult situation, and that's why a lot of people don't find the self-acceptance, because they sort of put that barrier up, that wall up, and they put up a front to hide of what they're behind. And you become very good liars, really, because you were living a lie. I was living a lie, but I was good at it. You know, I was hiding that I was bulimic. I was hiding the fact of my sexuality. And you become, it's scary. It becomes natural in a way. You know, you don't think twice about it. And that scared me because I'd been brought up by my mum and dad, you know, the say your please, your thank you, respect, to be honest. And I think, here I am, you know, lying to people, lying to my mum and dad, lying about a lot of things because I don't want people to find out because I was scared. And I was thinking, my God, this is becoming too easy, this lying, you know. I don't want to be like this. And that then obviously contributed to me then in sort of accepting who I was.
And you came out publicly in 2007, I believe, and you've spoken
I
about...
I came out in 2005, okay. But it came out in the press and stuff in 2007. Right. And it, I was on the Jonathan Show then. And obviously, I told my mum and dad. My mum was the first person I told. It took me about 3.5 hours just to tell her that word, that I was gay. We both cried, but nothing changed. And I let her tell my dad. It took her a couple of days, but but nothing changed. But my dad doesn't, it just goes straight over his head. He doesn't know what it's about. You know, he's accept who I am, and everything is fine between us, but he just doesn't know. A different generation, and that's fine, you know? And so they did find it difficult in sort of, you know, what other people were saying and scared of. And the most parents I've spoken to about this, they're not scared about it themselves. They're scared about how difficult life may be for their son or daughter. So that's what my mum and dad were scared for me. You know, is life going to be more difficult for me because I'm different? And that's what most parents are scared about, is how difficult it's going to be for their son and daughter, not for them. So anyway, it was a very difficult time for my mum and dad, but, you know, we were fine and got through that. And then we were doing the Jonathan Show. So about 2 years later, it came out in the press a bit. So most people knew, some people, if you followed rugby, you knew. And so, I mean, we were doing the Jonathan Show. And on the Jonathan Show, you had Delaney Sean, Roland Phillips and me were on the sort of bar. Jonathan was the main presenter. And then the opening line was, Roland would sort of come in usually dressed up or something. So the usual line was, Larry, what have you been up to this week? Nigel, what have you been up to? And where is he, Roland? Now, I do that role now. So anyway, Roland comes in all dressed up with the nonsense he was doing. So the writers decided, look, we can't do this programme without any reference to you now after you've come out, because people do know. And so we decided we're going to write into the programme in a simplistic way that... if people know, they'll know, but then we're not announcing it. And I said, well, how are we going to do that then? I said, well, when the programme starts, Larry will be in his seat, Jonathan will be in his seat, you won't be there, Roland won't be there. So Jonathan will ask, where's Nigel tonight? Larry's going to say in Welsh, well, I don't know where he is, but he said he was coming out, as in coming out to play. and then there's a closet on the stage. The closet door will open to the music of I Am Who I Am. And you will walk out, go to your seat, and that's it. Nobody will need to say anything. So at least people then will, if they know, they know. If they don't, then it just goes over the head. I said, right, okay. I said, are you happy with that? I said, oh, yeah, okay, that's fine. Because I didn't want to make an, oh, here I am, you know, so, and I don't like that. So anyway, we filmed the programme. It was a Christmas, New Year's Eve special. It was coming out on New Year's Eve. We were filming about 10 days before. And I then... sort of realise, oh, bloody hell. My mum and dad now are going to see this. They're going to have to go through this again now, and I don't want that to happen. So I sort of rang my mum and dad up, and I said, what are you doing New Year's Eve? I wasn't going out that night because I was reffing on New Year's Day in one of the Welsh derbies, so didn't go out New Year's Eve. I haven't been out for New Year's Eve for quite a few nights, a few years, because you're reffing on New Year's Day. So I rang my mum and dad and said, look, I'll pop up tomorrow morning now. I said, oh, we're going over the club, Money Kerrig Workingman's Club, my local club. I was living in Pontybarum, just down the road. We're going over the club tonight. There's a live band on in the club, New Year's Eve. But don't worry, they said, we've tape recorder back then, not the CD. We video recorded the Jonathan Show, so we'll watch that then when we get home or on... I don't know, damn. So anyway, they went with it. I thought, right, I still have a key to the house. So I thought, I went up to my mum's dad at house, and the video recorder had to pull the plug out, put it back in, and then it, because of the power cut, it would cancel the... So I put it back in, lights are flashing, So obviously they'd cancelled the recording. I said, right, great. So following morning, ring my mum and dad, Happy New Year's Day. Living there with her, Happy New Year's Day. I said, how'd it go last night in the club? Oh, we had a good night, they said, but the live band didn't turn up. I said, okay. So, well, what was the entertainment then? Oh, nothing. We had a game of bingo, which they usually do. We had the buffet, and then they put the Jonathan show on the big screen. And my mum said, and just as well, as she said, because the tape recorder hasn't worked. But obviously that must have just gone over their head, like, you know, because they were watching it in, you know, a room full of 120 people. So obviously people will be chatting. So, you know, whatever's happening at the beginning just must have gone over their head. So after all the effort I'd gone through, they'd actually seen me come out of the closet on the stage. And that's how it came out on the programme. After that, then just things became normal then, as normal as they can be for somebody in my situation, because life is not normal. Mm. You know, when particularly when you're refereeing rugby, people don't like you anyway. And people always ask me, well, why do you want to become a referee? And I said, well, I always knew I was going to be a referee, because even when I was in school, I wasn't liked. And so it became natural. And sort of, you know, people don't like you as a referee generally. And then the fact that you get on top of that, they're not even like you anymore. So life is not normal for me. Life is different. It is difficult at times. But as normal as it can be, you know, for somebody in my situation, you know, life has been pretty good. There's our downs, but, you know, the ups are much, much more relevant and much more often, thankfully, than those sort of down times are.
And you must be very grateful that it was so delicately handled by the Jonathan show, which is
yeah, I've had some sticks since mine, but it was done in just that subtle way.
Now, you are very aware of, you know, the power of your position and the example you give, and it's not something you sought, but you accept the fact that your life story and accepting who you are has been a sort of shining beacon for many other people. And you've spoken very eloquently, and I think this is, you know, played a part in you deciding to write your book about a woman getting in touch with you and saying that you essentially welcome.
A bit late. We nearly finished.
You missed the funny bits. You spoke about a woman who got in touch with you who said that, you know, you had essentially saved her son's life. So if you can just tell us that story briefly.
That was the trigger to write my book. That the Lolva, who published my book in Welsh, first of all, well, and the English book, they came to me and said, look, we'd like to do a book, because I was going to the World Cup. I was announced to go to the World Cup in 2007 as a very young, experienced referee. It was a bit of a shock. You were one of the sort of outsiders, really, myself and Wayne Barnes. And the Lolva came to me and said, look, we'd like to do a book because you've got a story to tell as well. And I said, well, look, I haven't achieved anything in refereeing, really, you know, compared to what other referees. I said, but, and plus as well, if I'm going to do a book, it has to be an honest account of my life. And I don't really want people to read what I've been through in my life, because once it's out there, it's out there. And they said, yeah, but, you know, people, you know, will find it interesting. It may help people. And I said, no, sorry. You know, when I finish refereeing, yes, maybe, but no. And then about 6 or 7 months later, I'd done an interview, something similar to this radio interview, and a press interview about going to the World Cup. And obviously they touched on the story, which we just spoke about earlier. And there was a couple of articles in the Times, the Guardians, the Wales on Western Mail, Wales on Sunday run an article on it. So, you know, it was out there. And obviously then it becomes on the internet. And I had a letter from this woman, she was just south of Exeter. And she wrote me this lovely handwritten letter saying, thank you for sharing my story, that it had helped save her son's life. And basically what had happened, a son that's sort of 16 years of age tried to take his own life. They managed to save him, but they didn't know why. He wouldn't tell them why, and they were just pretty much in that limbo. And it must be hell, because I know what it would be like, that they were just waiting when, if, will he do it again? Will we be able to save him again? And that, as a parent, must be the ultimate nightmare you're living with. And they had family and friends around, and obviously the reason why he didn't, he took his own life because he was dealing with his sexuality, but he didn't tell them. So they had friends around one night around the table, and they just announced the World Cup referees. And they were talking on the table. It was always a bit of a surprise that Nigel Owens and Wayne Barnes had been chosen to go to the ref as referees. And the father of the boy said, oh, isn't that Nigel Owens? Isn't he the gay referee? And the other guy said, yeah, he is. He said, oh, well, it doesn't matter if he's gay or not. You know, if he's good enough to go to the World Cup, then he's good enough to go. Now, this boy was hearing this conversation on the table. So he sort of left the table and went upstairs and typed in my name on Google and read this, what we briefly talked about earlier. And so after the family friends had gone home, he came down and he told his mum and dad, look, I've got something to tell you. And I get quite emotional when I talk about this. And he said to him, the reason why I try to take my own life is the same reason as why Nigel Owens did. And his mum and dad sort of said to him, look, because he knew now, but what the dad said, it was okay for him to tell them because it didn't matter to them in the nicest possible way. And he said, look, and they said, why? We don't care. You know, we love you as you as a child, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who you will fall in love with. We love you as our son. And she just wrote me this lovely letter saying just, you know, that it had helped, you know, save their son's life, and, you know, that now life was great and he was able to get on with his life. And then about 3 weeks after that, the Lolva came back and said, look, you know, it's been out, a bit of your story is in, they didn't know about this, a bit of a story now is out there in the press and stuff, you know, we really do want to make a book. We think it'll be very interesting and helpful for people. And I said, you know what, you're probably right because of this letter. And so I agreed to do the book, and that's how the Welsh book came. And then during that time, obviously my mum went ill, and then after that, then a lot of people asked, you know, when is the book going to come out in English? Because we weren't going to do it in English. And then it came out in English. And Gwyn Elvin, who's Acton Pobl y Cwm, sort of suggested the name for me half-time because I was pretty much halfway through my refereeing career, and he sort of suggested, you know, a name, because we were struggling on a name, and he said, well, why don't you call it Half Time? Because I said to the Lolva, look, I'll do this book on the proviso that when I do finish, I'll be able to do another book, because hopefully I'll have achieved a lot more in refereeing then, because I haven't at the moment. I haven't done a single final by then, I don't think, bar the Heineken Cup final I did in 2008. And that's where the name, the half time, comes about. And on the plan that when I do finish, it'll be full time. But probably now what has happened since then, as we mentioned earlier, was that this is not soccer moment. So when I do the next book, which I'm starting to do now in the next couple of months with the same publishers and the same ghostwriter, the book will be called This is Not Soccer. Will be the main name of the book.
Great name, it is. Fabulous name. Now, Nigel, I just want to pick up on something you said earlier, and I've heard you say in a few interviews, and it is that this, you know, that you find it unable to forgive yourself for what you put your parents through and for trying to take your own life. And I just want to sort of put to you almost that the young man whose mother got in touch with you, if he came to you and said, I'm finding it hard to forgive myself for doing that, for putting my parents through that, what would your advice to him be?
I would probably tell him the same thing that he would probably tell me, is the fact that, you know, we all make mistakes in life, and, you know, the fact that you've had the second chance and you've seen what you put your mum and dad through means that you will never go to that place and put people that matter you through that same thing again. And that to me is probably something I would tell him. That's, you know, it's worth you forgiving yourself, because, you know, your mum and dad know now that they don't have to worry about that anymore. And even though none of us would want to put our parents through that anguish and worry, which my mum and dad went through that night and probably went through, you know, ever since, or probably not so much now, but, you know, in the couple of months and years after that, in worrying, will it happen again? Will we get, you know, a chance again to get through this, or, you know, will it be too late the next time? And that's what I would probably tell him, that, look, you know, that we all make mistakes in life and we have to forgive them. And maybe that's something I need to tell myself, maybe.
Well, that's what I wanted to sort of say, because you're clearly, another value of yours is forgiveness. You've spoken very eloquently about forgiving the young man who bullied you at school and being able to see that it came from a dark place. And you're saying that this young guy whose life his mother told you saved, that they should forgive themselves. And yet a few times you've said that you can't forgive yourself. Could you see that perhaps you are being a little harsh on yourself then, and that could be that proverbial stone in the shoe?
Yeah, maybe you're right. But sometimes you don't, you know, it's a bit like you were saying earlier, you know, when people say that you're a role model, or, you know, you're a Welsh, you know, you don't see it that self, do you? You know, you'll see it in other people, and, you know, and a lot of people are very good at telling other people how to do things better or to forgive themselves, but sometimes you don't tell yourself that, and maybe that's something that I will maybe finally tell myself, maybe, and maybe you've helped me doing that.
Hooray. Do you think you could do that?
Yeah, you know, yeah, I suppose when you put it in that way, which I hadn't really thought about before, to be honest. Yeah, you know, I still, you know, I'm sort of disappointed that I put my mum and dad through that. And but yeah, I suppose my mum and dad have forgiven me, that's for sure. So, you know, maybe, yeah, I should forgive myself.
Yeah. So I sometimes get told off in reviews of the podcast for going off on my own personal tangents, but I just want to throw one in here, because my girlfriend and I talk about topics like this quite a lot, and a wiser man than myself and well told us that an easy way to think about it, we have a four-year-old at home and we find it easy to sort of love and care for her, and it's hard. A lot of us, we actually said, you know, how does one go about loving yourself? And he's like, well, it's very easy, you know how to do it for a four-year-old. But people find it much harder to do it for ourselves. Mm. And I think that's a very common thing. Do you go along with that? And why do you think we do struggle to give ourselves the breaks that we so easily give other people, as you've just illustrated?
It's a very... It's a very, very good point you made, really, and a very difficult one to answer, I think. And maybe that is maybe one of the reasons why men in particular, more so than women seem to be able to express their feelings and talk about difficult times with somebody, with each other, a little bit easier than men do, because we have that macho image, I guess. And sometimes, you know, the word love for men is, oh, no, that's not for men, you know, type of thing. And maybe that's one of the reasons. As men, you carry that burden of that macho image, mm-hmm. where, you know, actually to open up and express those feelings, to show that love, to show that care for other people and for yourself is actually a sign of great strength and not a sign of weakness. But for men in particular, we do seem to find it as a weakness and not a strength. And I think by getting people to see that what you see in other people and what you can tell other people to forgive themselves and the love you show for your child and stuff, when you can sort of turn that back on yourself, to sign that as a great strength of doing that rather than a weakness. And I think that maybe is something that will evolve with time, I believe, when sort of, you know, men talk more openly about issues in the life, where in the past it's very difficult to do that, and still it is now in the culture that was then, in that macho culture of the sort of, you know, the 20s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s and the 80s, where, you know, now society is different, and quite rightly so, men and women just, you know, can do the same jobs as in the past. You know, that job is not for a woman. Well, yes, a woman's just as good as doing that job as a man, and a man is just as good as doing that job as traditionally would have been a woman's job, you know. So I think that is something maybe that it comes with that openness, I believe, which we men in particular really do struggle with.
Yeah, vulnerability, definitely a strength. Now, we are sadly nearing the end of our time in this chat. A very last couple of bits I want to touch on. First of all, you know, you have spoken about your fear for the future in terms of, you know, you don't want to be alone. However, you know, you do choose to be a rugby referee, and a much beloved one at that, and that takes you off all around the world. And so to some degree, you choose that over the life you say you want. So why on earth then, when that stops, would you not get the life you want? What makes you think that you wouldn't get that?
I don't think I'm not sure if I choose it as the life I want. It happened, you know. I started refereeing at 16, but by chance, and then got opportunities to progress and become an international referee. And the way the game has evolved over the last 10, 15 years, where there's much more games, there's much more travelling. You know, 20 years ago, you'd referee in Wales and then you'd referee the odd game outside in Europe, maybe. But now, with the way that the Pro 14 League is, most weekends you're away. So it's something that's evolved, and you've evolved in that, because it is my job at the end of the day. And that job is, you know, is coming to an end in the next couple of years. And then I will be, I know I've bought about 30 acres of land, and I was out this morning helping them. There's a concreting the base of the shed. I'm going to get a couple of cattle when I come back from Japan. I'm going to keep a couple of cattle, get some chickens, get a couple of dogs again. And I'm looking forward to being home more and spending more time. My dad, as I said, is getting older, being around people, you know, the family and friends, and being at home. And maybe then that lifestyle will enable me to have a different lifestyle, because at the moment it's very difficult, you know, where you're away, you know. Was it last year, the year before last? I was away from home something like 190 nights of the year, somewhere in the world, in an hotel, sleeping on your own most of the time, but away in a in hotel bed in I'm joking, hotel, sleeping in, you know, all over the world. So I think, you know, and I love rugby and refereeing has saved my life. Between rugby and refereeing and my mum and my dad and my family have saved my life. And I will owe more to rugby and to my family and friends and to my mum and dad that they will ever owe to me. And I love refereeing, you know, but I am ready now as well to get to that next chapter of when it's, you know, coming to an end of the next season or so, and to be at home and maybe have a different life where, you know, I have a partner at the moment where the... We'll have more to the family when time goes on. I don't know. I haven't thought about that till now, because my life hasn't allowed that. So maybe life will be different, and I hope it will be, because, as I said, family is the most important thing. And strange, really, when somebody who says that family is the most important thing, and yet I worry about when I'm getting older that I'm going to be on my own. So, you know, that's something maybe that will naturally happen, hopefully, in the next couple of years.
Well, look, you've imagined a bleak future before, and you know your present and your career has been anything but, so there's no reason you couldn't be very wrong on that count again. And you spoke about you know, your gratitude to rugby, but rugby is very lucky to have you as well. And
I think rugby's lucky to have many people,
of course, and it is, but we're talking about you, Nigel. No one else is here. For goodness sake. Be nice to yourself. I know it just remains for me to say, you know, thank you very much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure having you, Nigel. I know you've got a few other bits here. Your book is on sale here as well, by the way, everyone, and it's a cracking read, or so I hear.
You haven't read it?
No. I've got a lot of books to get through. Let me just put that on. Let's give it one more cheer and a clap. Nigel Owens, the one and only.
Thank you very much, Owens. It's been my pleasure. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed this conversation. For my newsletter called A New Way of Being, head to simonmundy.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.